already been stated, it's good for us to be here. Winter certainly looks like it's setting in. Might be able to make use of that fact a little bit later on in my lesson, we'll see. If you want to follow along with the lesson, please turn to the first chapter of the book of Romans. We'll be reading a few verses from there before we actually get into the lesson. Again, we want to take the opportunity here to welcome each and every one of you, especially if you're visiting with us. We hope that, first of all, that we serve God and we please God, and that in doing so, you might find it pleasing to you and that you might want to come back, and certainly we would invite you any time that you have an opportunity. In Romans chapter 1, in verse 16, Paul there says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation, to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek." Then in verse 17 he says, "For therein is revealed a righteousness of God." So Paul is telling us here what is revealed in this gospel, what is there for us. It's something that is righteousness. It's not something that's mythical. It's not something that's a fable, but it is the righteousness of God. But drop down with me for just a minute, if you will, to verse 18. And he also says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hinder the truth in unrighteousness." So not only is the righteousness of God revealed in the gospel, the things that he wants us to do, but his wrath is also revealed against those who would hinder it in unrighteousness. So there is this balance. You know, some people today say, all you have to do is to preach love and the love of God. But the love of God is not all that's in the gospel. There is that reward for doing righteousness, and there is that condemnation for doing evil. Just as there is a heaven prepared and a mansions prepared in John chapter 14, there is a lake that burns with fire that's mentioned in the book of Revelation. Both weigh equally, both come from the same gospel, both are revealed. What I would like to really take a good look at tonight then is also in verse 18. It says, "This wrath of God is revealed against men who hinder the truth." I believe the King James Version in this verse says, "who hold the truth." The American Standard, which I just read from, talks about hindering the truth. And as we think about how the gospel is spread, how we can read the Bible and find it, there are always, will always be, and always has been, those who want to hinder the spread of this gospel. As we read through the New Testament, as we read through the Bible, we find that Satan has always been opposed to the spread of the truth. And Satan's angels, those who worship him, have been a part in this hindrance. But we as people who claim not to worship Satan, and I'm talking now about the Christian, quote, people, the religious neighbors that we have who claim Christianity, think they're not hindering it, but yet there are those who hinder this truth in unrighteousness. And we'll take a look at some of these things as we go on through this first chapter of the book of Romans. In verse 19, he says, "Because that which is known of God is manifest in them, for God manifested unto him. For the invisible things of him since the creation of the world are clearly seen, being perceived through the things that are made." So what Paul is talking about here is that God has revealed his truth, and God has revealed himself. He's talking about things that were clearly made. You know, as we set about and we look about this earth, there are certain things that man has made. The benches that you're sitting in, the building that we're now listening in or meeting in, the cars which you drove to this service, those things were made by man, and man's intelligence, man's creativity is manifested in those things. But the things of God that are manifested are the things which man has not made. And those kinds of things is what Paul is talking about here. David, I believe, said in the book of Psalms that he was fearfully and wonderfully made. Now, did you ever stop and think about your body? Everything it does for you? You know, you see things. I look out and I can see you. The older I get, the ones in the back get a little blurry, but you can still see, and you look forward and you can see me. You may not want to look too long, but you can do it. You can look and see who's next to you. You can look down at your New Testament and you can read. Did you ever stop to think what it takes to see? All the mechanisms, all the things that the scientists have learned about the eyeball and what it takes and the nerve channels that go back into the brain and all the registration. You know, we've tried to capture this. You know, we have things such as photographs and TV, and we have in effect modeled what can be done, but yet it cannot be reproduced as we are. You know, it cannot be regenerated. The eye is something that moves. Man has to take this TV camera and move it to see what he wants to see, but we can hear something and look real quick. In your hands, you know, think about all the things that you can do with your fingers. Man has tried to copy this in his robots, and if you go into any industrial plant today, you'll see these robots picking things up and placing them all very nicely, all at the same speed, all in the same direction. But yet your hand can move in any direction it wants to, and it's guided by a brain. Truly, we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and the intelligence of God is manifested there. We think machines can't. Machines have to be programmed by another man. David also said that the heavens declare the handiwork of God, and we look at the stars and we look at the planets and how everything goes around. As we mentioned, it's winter's coming upon us. That's one of the seasons that God has created by spinning us around the sun or putting us in orbit. And have we been able to create anything that great? No. But look about you and look at the fields of corn that are now being harvested, and beans and the wheat that was harvested in the summertime. In all of man's creation, he's never been able to reproduce things like God has. We always talk about from little acorns, you know, the big oak trees grow. Somewhere in this audience, there's probably some little child that has one of these little miniature cars. Now, if we could go out back and dig up a little bit of earth and plant that little miniature car, and at the end of 90 days or 120 days, we've got us a Cadillac, we've got something, don't we? But we can't do that. But yet we can go out here and we can take that one little kernel of corn off an ear and we can plant it in the ground and it'll reproduce a hundredfold. You know, most of you probably got some kind of coin in your pocket. That's something that man has made. You know, if I could take that nickel out there and plant it in the ground and it would reproduce a hundredfold, there'd be a shortage of nickels, wouldn't there? Now, I could reach in there and I could grab a dollar bill or a $5 bill or a $10 bill. Wish you had a couple of 20s or two, but Becky won't let me out of the house with anything more than a 20. And you could plant that and it would reproduce a hundredfold. What would we have? Man can't do that. But yet, that little kernel of wheat does that. That little acorn, that little hickory nut. All these things are evidence that God is. We regenerate things. God regenerates things. We have seen over the years that God reproduces the human race. We have big children, little children to prove it, and children that are not yet born. That's God's intelligence. Man has not been able to do that. He has to get his hammer and his soldering iron and his torch and nails and everything else to put all of these things together. So the evidence is there. And then he says in the final part of verse 20, he says, even his everlasting power and divinity, that they may be without excuse. Think about it. Here is all this evidence that we have to verify that God is. Is there anyone who can make an excuse they didn't know? Has God ever withheld anything from man? You know, there's not a human being that ever existed on this earth or ever will exist on this earth who cannot see a tree, who cannot see the flower, who cannot see things grow, who cannot witness the fact that he can't do it. Some people say, well, I planted that seed. That's right, but you didn't make it grow. I built that car, sure you did. And you'll have to go out and build another one. You're not going to plant a little one and make it grow. But God's seeds grow. The evidence is there. He says in verse 21, then, because that knowing God, they glorified him not as God, neither gave him thanks, but became vain in their reasonings, and their senseless heart was darkened. You know, it's always been a problem of man throughout the ages that his mind has done him in. He has become too smart for himself. He has had reasonings. And in this particular time in Roman era, in a Greek era, you had all these Greek philosophers, all these Roman philosophers, and they had their theories about what happened. You know, and we look back at our own Indians that were here prior to the coming of the pilgrims. Now, nobody ever thought that they were like Plato or Socrates or some of these things. But look at what they did. They reasoned in their own mind, and they had their gods just the same as the Greek gods. They didn't have nice-sounding names like theirs did. But there was a god of fire and the god of harvest and the god of the wind and the god of the rain and the god of the sun and all of these things. And as the men reasoned in their hearts, they produced these gods for themselves. If you've ever studied Latin in high school, as a lot of us have, you did some study of the Latin mythology and the Greek mythology. And this was all written down, and they're quite elaborate stories. But yet, they were all the result of the thinking of man. Now, going back to verse 18, when we talked about hindering, hindering the truth, think about what some of these things do to it. When man becomes so involved in himself that he creates these false gods, and then others view these gods. And we think about the Roman Empire. You know, we talked Wednesday night here a few weeks ago in a class on Revelation, how the Caesar wanted to be worshipped. Think about how that hinders the truth. You know, now man has to take this big sieve and put everything that he knows in there and sift it out to find out what the truth and what isn't the truth. So the wrath of God is revealed against those who hinder the truth. And Paul, the writer here, is telling us how these things have been hindered. First of all, they recognize that it takes some sort of being, but they have their reasonings and their thoughts become vain and go off on some tangent somewhere. And as that happens, then other things begin to develop. He says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And again, go back to the era of the Greeks and the Romans. What did they do? I'm the wise man Plato. Well, there must be some unknown force that governs the wind, and another force over here that governs the rain, and another force that governs the sun. And all this stuff begins to develop because somebody thought a lot of this man Socrates, and he had a lot of logical thinking, at least in their mind. But notice verse 23, it says, thinking themselves wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God for the likeness of an image of corruptible man. Some people might take a look at this verse and say that word changed means converted. But I want you to think along these lines for a minute tonight. You cannot change the glory of God. Man cannot alter it. God's glory will be his glory forever and forever and forever. And not a thing that any one of us can do, or any man on this earth or woman on this earth, can alter that glory. We can't bring God down to our level. His glory will stand up there supreme. So the idea here is perhaps not changed so much as exchanged. Now we're looking from man to God now. They have changed God's glory that he has revealed to us and exchanged it for some other glory. In other words, they have ignored God and exchanged the true God for a false God. And it says the likeness, the image of corruptible man, of birds, and four-footed beasts and creeping things. And all you have to do is look through your encyclopedia, take a trip over into the Rome area, the Holy Land as we call it now, take a trip out through our western area or a museum someplace, and you'll see where man began to worship his own image. He began to worship the image of beasts. India, for example, right now worships the cow. You know, it's a sacred animal. Some places, animals, period, are sacred because they think it's their ancestors who have come back in this form, and it's, you know, if you swat that fly, it could have been your great-great-grandfather. And you don't want to do that. So nothing is killed. So all of these things are brought about by the reasonings of men. And once they do this, in verse 24, he says, "Wherefore God gave them up in the lust of their hearts and the uncleanness, that their bodies should be dishonored among them." And he says, not only have they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for a likeness, but they have exchanged the truth for a lie. Now, going back to what Paul has been talking about in this whole first chapter, he talks about in verses 1 through 5 there about the gospel and how it was something that was preached, and how that Jesus had died, was buried, and resurrected. Paul said he wasn't ashamed of it. It went to the Jew and to the Greek. But the people wouldn't listen to it. They would exchange the truth of God for a lie. It's not God that brings the rain. It's this God that sets up on Mount Olympus somewhere. And it's not God that brings the sunshine. It's this other fellow. And it's not God that creates the relationship between man and woman. It's this goddess somewhere. So rather than listen to what was revealed, these people begin to exchange the truth for a lie. And it says, and they worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. It's kind of like going out here and trying to worship this tree as if that tree had created itself. Go out here and worship this lion, for this lion has created itself. Not looking beyond what is seen in front of them. It goes on to talk about once they had exchanged this, they had served the creature and not the creator. The next thing to hinder this was the individual passions of men. And they begin to serve the passions that were in them. It talks about the women changed the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise men, leaving the natural use of women, burned in their lust one toward another. And men working unseemliness and receiving themselves the recompense of their error, which was due. So the normal passions of men and women were altered. And you can just see that the thing beginning to degrade into just about what we've got today, isn't it? You can see it happening in the Roman Empire. You can see it happening even today. But it all starts back with when we recognize or fail to recognize what God has given to us. And right there is where we begin to hinder the spread of the truth. In verse 28, it says, even as they refused to have God in their knowledge, he gave them up to a reprobate mind to do those things which were not fitting, and being filled with all. And take a look at this list. Might want to mark this down and take a good look at it tonight when you get home. If you want to know what a reprobate mind is, look at what it brings forth. Look at what it causes here. Unrighteousness, wickedness, covetous, malicious, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, hateful to God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, unmerciful, who knowing the ordinance of God, that they that practice such things are worthy of death. Inventors of evil things. Have you ever stopped and think what that is? Inventors of evil things. We look around about us and there is a large contingent of people who are against pornography. Is that an evil thing? Did God give it to us? We invented it. And we continue to invent things that will take us away from what God wants us to do. Inventors of evil things. But notice he says in verse 32, he says, who, meaning those who know the ordinance of God, that they that practice such things are worthy of death. And what we've done here, what Paul has done, has laid down and told them what the gospel is. And if we recognize that gospel and we know what it is, then we can immediately recognize those things that were brought about to hinder the gospel. We'll recognize the vain reasonings. We'll recognize that all these things here are sinful. But notice what he also says. He says, who not only do the same, but also consent with them that practice them. And that's a very interesting statement there. If we look at that list and we see all of these wicked things happening, it says those people who commit them are worthy of death. It says not only the ones that are doing the actual act, but those who consent or condone what they're doing. It's one thing to see it practiced. It's yet another to condone it. And yet, as we look around in the religious world, people are condoning what the other one does in an effort to gain unity. Oh, you don't believe in baptism. Well, that's all right. Wait a minute. You don't believe that Jesus is truly the Son of God. Well, that's all right. All of these things, are those evil? Are those sinful? Are those truthful? And yet there are people today consenting along with them. In chapter 2, he starts out, wherefore thou art without excuse, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou shalt judge, for thou that judgest dost practice the same things. And we sat here now or listened for, if I could read the clock, about 20 minutes. And maybe a lot of you've got the us and them syndrome. You're sitting there thinking, well, you know, what he's talking about up there and what Paul is writing about, that's them. That's not us. They do that. You know, have you ever gotten into those kind of situations? Maybe sometimes you get to talking about different races of people, and it's us and them. And we always say, it's them over there. But what is Paul saying here? He says, thou that judgest another, thou condemnest thyself because you do the same thing. Let's take a look for just a minute over in Luke chapter 14. You know, there were a lot of things that happened there, a lot of things that we can recognize as being immediately evil. In the 16th verse of Luke chapter 14, it said, but he said unto him, a certain man made a great supper, and he bade many. And he sent forth his servant at supper time to say to them that were bidden, come, for all things are now ready. Now here we have just about the same thing we were talking about in Romans chapter 1. We have God, who is the creator, who is the maker of everything, the man who has made preparation, the God who has made preparation for us to spend eternal life with him in heaven. The same God who has extended the invitation. He says he bade many. Now, as we look at the Old Testament, we see where God delivered his law to the patriarchs. We see where he delivered his law to the Jews under Moses. We see where he delivered his law to the prophets who guided the people under the old law. And today we can see quite readily where he has delivered his law unto us. It's not foreign to anybody. It's not unattainable. It is here. So this bidding, God has bidden each and every one of us. He has made preparation. He says, come, all things are now ready. And it says, and they all with one consent began to make excuse. What was the first one there? He says, the first said unto him, I have bought a field and I must go out and see it. Something took his mind away from this feast, away from this supper, away from the bidding of the king. And his excuse was that it's this field, it's this possession that I have. And another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen and I go to prove them. I pray thee, have me excused. Sounds like a legitimate excuse. He's got, maybe in our day, you know, instead of 5 yoke of oxen, he's brought him a new Corvette or a new Z28 or something. And boy, I really got to go out and drive this. And finally, another one said, I have married a wife and therefore cannot come. Okay? And the servant came and told his Lord these things. Now, remember these 3 excuses and go back over to Romans chapter 1 where we were, or Romans chapter 2. And what did the Apostle Paul say there? Wherefore thou art without excuse. These excuses that these individuals made over here weren't any good. And you can probably sit here for another hour or two and talk about why those excuses weren't any good. But the idea is here God has delivered his plan. He has delivered his communication. He has made all the preparation. These people that were talked about in Romans chapter 1 were very much against it and is very well recognized. But what about these people in Luke chapter 14? Did they or did they not hinder the truth? They didn't attend the supper. They didn't make preparation to go. They did not take advantage of the things that God had prepared for them. Think about it. Did they hinder the truth by their excuses? Sure they did. And he says, here we are, or here you are, condemning these people for their idol worship, and yet you're doing the same thing. And that's where we as Christians need to be very careful, is that we don't run out here condemning our religious neighbors and turn around and take a bite out of the same apple. That we need to be very careful about what we do, and that we need not make excuse for what's going on. We need to have, as one guy says, that index finger religion. Not an excused religion, but where we can put our finger on the thing that's there. And let's not be making these kinds of excuses. We hinder the gospel if we do. And finally in verse 3 he says, and think about this, or reckonest this, O man, who judgest them that practice such things and doest the same, that thou shalt escape the judgment of God. Now here we are, we're saying that these people in Romans chapter 1 are condemned to the lake of fire and brimstone. Are we not just as guilty if we make smaller errors, smaller hindrances, smaller excuses, if we don't do what God wants us to do? Perhaps the writer of Hebrews says it best in Hebrews chapter 2. In verse 3, when the great question is asked there, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? You know, there's other ways to make excuse other than outright, like these 3 individuals did here in Luke chapter 14. We can make excuse by simply neglecting, not doing what we know we ought to do. And as it said in Hebrews, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? It says, which having at the first been spoken through the Lord, was confirmed unto us by them that heard, God also bearing witness with them by both signs and wonders and by manifold powers and by gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. So what all this is going to boil down to here is that, again, God has prepared the supper. He has sent us a written invitation. It's up to us whether or not we want to accept that invitation and go to the supper. But notice in Hebrews chapter 2, first spoken by the Lord, eyewitness testimony and miraculous testimony that verify this. And it's all there, and it's all in the book, and it's all in black and white, and it's all been given to us. Will we hinder it by putting our own thoughts into it, as some of these philosophers did in Grecian times? Have we been hindered by some of these people? Have we actually been hindered by people who teach lies, who don't teach the truth? Certainly it's being hindered now. Do we hinder it by not putting it to practice? Of the whole lesson, the one great question is, how shall we escape? God has given it to us. He has confirmed it. He has said that it's the truth. He has shown it miraculously to be the truth. And He has given us every opportunity and every bit of evidence. We are without excuse. There is no reason for any individual to deny the invitation of the Lord, not to come to the supper. The evidence is there, the physical evidence, the word is there. What else is there? What excuse can we make? What excuse are you making tonight for not obeying the gospel? Have you got one? Do you think it's legitimate? Did you see it in anything that was said tonight? If you did, then it did any good. In fact, Paul said there in Romans, you are without excuse. He didn't make any exceptions there. There's not a thing that you can come up with tonight that God will listen to in the day of judgment. We are without excuse. If we don't make heaven, it's going to be our fault, not God's fault. He has given it all to us. If you're in any way subject to the gospel call, won't you come while we stand and while we sing a song of invitation?